Back with you, sitting down and chatting it up on Tuesday, June 11th, 2024 on Connecticut Today, where we open the show looking at the charges facing four campaign workers connected to Bridgeport's 2019 Democratic mayoral primary, while State Senate Republican leader Steve Harding weighed in as well on those four arrests. Hartford Current sports writer Dom Amore stopped by with inside details on UConn men's basketball head coach Dan Hurley's decision to return to the school, and finally, Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio joined us for her weekly chat.
Well, it only took, what, 5 years? Is that it, right? Let's see, 2024 minus 2019. Carry the two, divided by three, give or take a few months. Yes, we finally have news of arrests of alleged funny business. Again, let's be fair here. We live in a country where the theory is innocent till proven guilty, as opposed to other countries where you're guilty and got to prove your innocence. It doesn't work that way here. But finally, four people arrested facing various charges, not in the absentee ballot shenanigans that went on a few months ago in 2023, but the ones I know, if you're scoring at home, you need a scorecard here. In case you're scoring at home, as the great late Lindsey Nelson used to say. No, Maud, Grandpa, we're talking about 2019 here. Talking about 2019, not a lot to tell you. Various news reports. There have been some comments, though, made on this. The Connecticut Mirror reporting their version with Dave Altomare and Andrew Brown. Prosecutors charging four Bridgeport political operatives early today with abusing the absentee ballot system. Shocking. During the city's 2019 Democratic primary for mayor. The four individuals, Bridgeport City Councilman Alfredo Castilla and Wanda Jeter Pataki, the vice chair of the city's Democratic Party, who's again mixed up in some of the alleged funny business last year. The Connecticut Chief State's Attorney also charging Nilsa Heredia and Josephine Edmonds, two other campaign workers who were connected to the 2019 election between Mayor Joe Ganim and his Democratic challenger at the time, Marilyn Moore. All four defendants are specifically charged with unlawfully possessing another person's absentee ballot, as well as several other less serious election-related crimes. Castillo, Heredia, and Wanda Jeter Pataki all supported Joe Ganim in the campaign. Edmonds, however, worked for the Maryland Moore campaign. All four arrested Tuesday morning. I guess when they heard there were warrants out for their arrests, they signed a promise to appear in Superior Court on the 24th of this month. So today is the 11th, 18th, 25th. So 2 weeks from yesterday, they will be in Bridgeport Superior Court. So here is the statement that was put out by the Chief State's Attorney's Office, Patrick Griffin. Mr. Griffin saying, quote, "The integrity of our voting process is vital to our democracy." He continues, quoting him again, "I appreciate the attention and time the Statewide Prosecution Bureau put into these investigations. I hope these prosecutions will send a message deterring tampering with election results in the future." Close quote. Let's see if we have statements here. We do. Joe Ganim says here, Bridgeport mayor, according to the Connecticut mayor, declined an interview request from the mayor today, but his office issued a statement. In the statement from the Ganim office here, it points out that one of the four people arrested worked for Marilyn Moore. This is the statement coming from the mayor's office, quote, "We only learned through the media that individuals from both 2019 mayoral campaigns have been charged with election violations." Statement continues again from the mayor's office, quote, "We have not been provided with any details other than what is contained in the media reports." Now, Marilyn Moore did speak here, I guess, with some outlets and the Connecticut Mirror. Here's what she did. And there's a there's a key phrase or sentence here that Marilyn Moore has here that I applaud her for saying. Now, she says, quote, "For me, it doesn't matter who did it. If you did it, it's wrong. I don't care whose campaign you are in or who you are helping. Wrong is wrong. And I would hope that they are all treated equally. If I had known that," she continues, again, this is from Marilyn Moore, quote, "if I had known that, it would have nipped it in the bud right away. I believe in right and wrong strongly. I would not have tolerated it if I had known." Now, okay, we'll take Marilyn Moore at her word there. And I think that's the thing you have to do. Take people at their word. Now, of course, everybody's going to say, listen, if I had known, I would have stopped it. But let's take that at her word. But it's interesting, the next paragraph here, the Connecticut Mirror, plays into her next quote. "Moore blamed the continued problems with absentee voting in Bridgeport on the culture in the city and the cutthroat nature of local campaigns." Marilyn Moore said, quote, "It is a culture, and it is what people have grown up with in Bridgeport," unquote. She sounds right to me. I mean, she's right. If something is absorbed by osmosis into the culture of any city or town, never mind Bridgeport, any city or town in any state of the country, of course, people are going to kind of roll their eyes and go, whatever. That's not good. Again, Marilyn Moore blaming the continued problems with absentee voting in Bridgeport on the culture in the city and the cutthroat nature of local campaigns. Again, she said, quote, "It is a culture, and it's what people have grown up with in Bridgeport," close quotes. Now she's right there. Here's my thought on this, and the phones are open if you want to jump in here early. What do you think about this? 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Now, here's my next question here. And this should be the question of every law-abiding resident in the city of Bridgeport and in New Haven and in Hartford and in Waterbury and Meriden, Middletown, Danbury, any big and small city in this state. Now what happens? And what is, now I'm not familiar with the statutes here, what happens now? So it took almost, now sit and think about this. It took almost 5 years to get some arrest on this. 5 years. They built the new Yankee Stadium in, what, a year and a half for the time they broke ground? 2 years? Right? 5 years, we went from having rockets blow up on launch pads at Cape Canaveral, later to become Cape Kennedy, to, you know, docking two spacecraft in orbit around the Earth in the Gemini missions. 5 years, a long time. Why did it take so long? That's what people need to ask. I don't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or a MAGA or a non-MAGA or you're a socialist or a communist or a fascist or a Nazi. That's not the issue here. The question everybody should ask is 5 years, almost 5 years, 2019 till almost election day of or primary day of 2014 to the fall. Why did that take 5 years? I don't know. I'm not an expert here. My pay grade is nowhere near that high. Maybe somebody can edumacate me on this. What are the specific charges listed here on the website of our good friends at News 8? 52-year-old Alfredo Castillo, unlawful possession of absentee ballots, misrepresenting eligibility requirements for voting by absentee, failure to maintain an absentee ballot distribution list, failure to sign as an assister on a ballot. 67-year-old Wanda Jeter Pataki, unlawful possession of an absentee ballot, tampering with a witness, misrepresenting eligibility requirements for voting by absentee, failure to sign as an assister on an absentee ballot.
61-year-old Nilsen Heredia, unlawful possession of an absentee ballot, tampering with a witness, misrepresenting eligibility requirements for voting by absentee, failure to maintain an absentee ballot distribution list, being present when an absentee ballot applicant executes an absentee ballot. 62-year-old Josephine Edmonds, unlawful possession of absentee ballots, tampering with a witness, failure to maintain an absentee ballot distribution list, being present when an absentee ballot applicant executes an absentee ballot. All we should presume are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law or they enter a plea. Charges stem, of course, from allegations that absentees were mishandled in the September 2019 Democratic primary. So what do you think? Here's the other question. My first question is, why so long? Honestly, what takes so long? This wasn't a murder investigation. We weren't following, you know, money laundering through Central American cartels. we weren't trying to trace back the origins of an international arms smuggling operation here. Why on earth did this take 5 years? Five. We're talking four people here, not 14 or 15. 5 years. And, folks, these charges here, the notion that we're going to talk about this, this doesn't have anything to do with what we saw, the funny business we saw last year in the primary season. Mind-boggling. And here's the question, too. Is this going to make any difference? Honestly, if this results, now I have less than zero idea how these cases are put forth in court, what the potential penalties are. I got to tell you something. And look, I'm not counsel, I'm not defense, I'm not prosecution, but if people see a slap on the wrist on these, can you blame them for being cynical? Arrests finally in Bridgeport in connection, no, not with 2023. That's still an open book, 2019. A lot going on here, including the big news today that four people turned themselves in earlier today to the state police barracks in Bridgeport as they heard there were arrest warrants out for them, all in connection to some alleged absentee ballot funny business. Not in 2023, not the video that was seen a few months ago, but the 2019 follies. Alfredo Castillo, Wanda Jeter-Pataki, Nilsen Heredia, and Josephine Edmonds all facing various charges. Of course, we fully believe in innocent till proven guilty. But there are some people at the General Assembly saying, hey, we told you so. And if we don't get tougher on this, in some ways at least, this won't stop. Among those, a Republican state Senate leader in front of the station, Steve Harding, who joins us. Steve, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Paul, good afternoon. Always great to be on with you. Thank you for having me.
Steve, you heard of these four people turning themselves in this morning to the state police after, an investigation that somehow took 5 years. We'll get to that later. But what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, it's good to finally see, you know, the justice system working in regards to voter fraud. You really started to question after the fact that, to your point, it's been 5 years, whether or not anything was ever going to be done, whether or not there truly was an investigation into this, and whether or not we take, you know, voter fraud in our state seriously based upon this significant length of time. I mean, one of the things that I do question is, you know, what was the alleged fraud that we saw on video last summer, the impetus to all this. You know, I do question whether or not these arrests would have ever come if not for Wanda Pataki Jeter being caught red-handed on video, essentially committing voter fraud. And so it really brings into question and it brings to light ultimately what we as legislators have an obligation to do, which is implement measures to ensure that there's voter confidence in our elections. And there's safeguards in place, particularly as it relates to these absentee ballot systems that we have, to ensure that there's integrity in our election and that the results that are reported to us on election evening are true, accurate, and legal. And when you see what happened in Bridgeport in 2023, and then obviously what has led to these arrests dating back in 2019, there are clearly not enough safeguards and provisions in place to prevent these actions of fraud from occurring, because at least there's been probable cause in this matter. And there's certainly been substantial circumstantial evidence on videotape dating back to 2023, what happened last summer, that voter fraud is unfortunately ripe in Bridgeport. And this is only what we've seen. There has been other convicted cases in West Hartford and in Stanford and other municipalities in our state. Something needs to be done. And unfortunately, legislative Democrats don't seem to really want to do much about this.
Steve Harding, the guest. Steve, a couple of paragraphs here from the Connecticut Mirror story on this I found interesting. And we should mention that one of the people, Steve, and you probably know this, who were arrested today at State Police, Troop G in Bridgeport there, one of them was a worker apparently for Marilyn Moore, who was involved in the 2019 campaign. Marilyn Moore said this. Now, the Connecticut Mirror, Steve, said Moore blamed the continued problems with absentee voting on Bridgeport and the culture in the city and the cutthroat nature of campaigns. She said, quote, "It's a culture and it's what people have grown up with in Bridgeport." And the Mirror continued here. She also wants to see public employees who are convicted of absentee ballot crimes lose their pensions and other benefits. And she ends up here, Steve. Here's a direct quote from Marilyn Moore. Quote, "Unless you are punished for it severely and appropriately, then why not do it again?" Unquote. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, she summarizes it perfectly there, and she actually highlights one of the biggest components of what Senate Republicans and Senator Sampson and his role on the Government Administrations and Elections Committee presented to legislative Democrats, or at least Senate Democrats, this past legislative session. And one of the components of our election safeguards that we put in place would put a mandatory minimum 1-year jail sentence on any individual convicted of voter fraud. And to Senator Moore's point, unless you put significant deterrences in place, it seems pretty obvious here that you're not going to have enough of a deterrence to stop individuals from committing these crimes. So, that's exactly why I think that was one of the most significant aspects to what Senate Republicans proposed. And unfortunately, every single Senate Democrat in the legislative session voted against implementing that measure, which would have put a mandatory minimum 1-year jail sentence on, on an individual that committed voter fraud. To her point, I agree with her. Unless you put deterrences in place, unless the punishment is quite severe, there's not going to be a level of deterrence necessary, obviously, from stopping individuals from committing these crimes. And frankly, putting into question what is ultimately the bedrock of our democracy, which is our election system here in our country.
Steve Harding, the guest. Steve, but some of your compadres on the other side of the aisle have heard what you and other people say, and they say, well, though, mandatory minimum sentences or a 1-year minimum, they say they didn't like that because it would cut down on the discretion of a judge at sentencing or tie their hands needlessly. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would argue that they're hypocritical in their statements on that, because they have no problem taking away discretion from judges and making more criminal penalties more lenient, frankly. So I would question why, when we're putting in place measures that would make criminal sentences stiffer, that they would have a they want judges' discretion then, but they don't want it when they implement measures which would mandate judges be more lenient in how they adjudicate the law. I find that to be extremely hypocritical, and it's just simply another excuse for not wanting to take this seriously. And that's really what it comes down to, because there are some crimes that are so inherently important to either protecting public safety or so inherently important to protecting our democracy. And as I just mentioned, elections are the bedrock of it, that we have to set a standard in which there's really very minimal discretion, in that we have to punish this seriously. as we have to set a deterrence. It's really that plain and that simple. And I think what we've seen in other cases in which individuals either pled guilty or were convicted of voter fraud in Connecticut in recent years, they've simply received fines.
Yeah.
And they've walked away. And so, you know, I think setting a standard that if you are convicted of this, you are going to go to jail. I don't know what is more of a deterrence than that, and I think it would go a long way in preventing this from occurring moving forward.
And, Steve, finally, you and I mention all this knowing, and I think I have this right, correct me if I'm wrong on the calendar here, but isn't there going to be a question on the ballot, Steve Harding, coming up in November regarding whether or not voters want the state to okay essentially what would be mail-in voting or absentee ballot voting with zero restrictions? Are we still looking at that for an Election Day question or not?
My understanding is that, and I'll confirm this, but my understanding is that there has to go through one more round of an election site, another legislature, to put that ultimately on the ballot for a vote. But the Democrats have not been shy about the fact that they are going to bring that up once again. And if it passes this time with a simple majority in the legislature, then it will be on the ballot in the subsequent election year for voters to determine whether or not they would like this no-excuse absentee ballots to be implemented. But I think to your point, Paul, and you make a really good point, you know, if we don't have safeguards in place surrounding our absentee ballot system, how would we logically want to implement this then?
Yeah.
We're basically providing more unfettered access to absentee ballots, a system in which we know voter fraud is being committed surrounding. I mean, I think that we, as policymakers, should be, you know, pumping the brakes a little bit and saying, wait, before we provide no-excuse absentee ballots, let's make sure we have safeguards in place to ensure that this type of fraud can't occur again before we ultimately implement it for our voters to access. I think it just makes logical sense. I understand, you know, providing as much access to our polls as possible. We as Senate Republicans want that. But all we're saying is, at the same exact time, we want to ensure that there's confidence in our election system and that we have reasonable, common sense measures in place that prevent individuals from committing fraud within our system.
All right. Steve Harding, State Senate Republican leader out of Brookfield. Steve, thank you as always. Take care. Drive safely. And we'll talk to you later.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. Thank you. Well, there you go. All right. So a long time ago in a land far, far away, when I had far fewer pounds and far more hair, I shared a newsroom with this gentleman. We went our separate ways, but we've kept in touch every so often. Dominic Amore, Dom Amore, sports writer extraordinaire for years of the New Haven Register and now for years of the Hartford Current. He has followed UConn athletics exhaustively and is here now on the program to highlight us and fill us in as to the Danny Hurley saga over the past few days. Dom, it's Paul. It's been a minute. How are you?
Great, Paul. How are you doing? Great to hear your voice again.
Yeah, good to hear yours, too. And boy, Dom, it must have been a crazy few days. When did this break, Dom? Was it the ESPN reports or whatever that say, hey, Dan Hurley is kind of sniffing around? So take my listeners who keep calling and asking about this, take us through step by step what happened in this process, as best you know.
Well, as best I know, you know, Dan was at two events in Connecticut last week. He was at the Franciscan Sports Banquet on Tuesday night. He was at the UConn Coaches Roadshow in Stamford on Wednesday night, speaking to fans and posing for selfies and talking to reporters afterward. Made no mention of anything like this, of course. And he basically said that the contract was not going quite as well as he had hoped or as fast as he had hoped. It was kind of complicated. But he wasn't a businessman. His agent was advising him. Well, of course, while he was saying these things, obviously, Adrian Wojnarowski, the great NBA news hound at ESPN, had already had 3,000 words written to post the next morning at 7 a.m. that he was on it. He's going to be considering an offer from the Lakers. Lakers were preparing a, quote, massive offer. And he would be heading out there. Then it was step by step. We learned he was going out there. We didn't learn many details of that. But nothing about this was ordinary. Nothing about it really added up the way these kinds of things usually played out. It was very, very strange. And so I did not think he was going to go to the Lakers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even assuming, you know, the reports of what their offer was going to be were massively overblown in the end. But even if they were as big as first reported, I did not think he was going to go. This just didn't add up to me. But ultimately, he was supposedly torn 50-50. And if you're torn 50-50 about going to coach the Lakers, then, you know, you don't want to coach the Lakers, right? I mean, you don't just go and do it.
Right.
So he ended up yesterday staying at UConn. But he really never skipped a beat on of his UConn coaching duties except for the one day in and out of Los Angeles, which is very, very – and it seemed to me that he would have taken a lot more time in L.A. talking to more people, scouting out houses, places to live,
yeah,
if he were really serious about doing it. So I felt like it was a bargaining chip to get UConn to move the needle a little bit.
Sure, yeah.
If it wasn't that, then because I'm, you know, people are telling me, no, you're wrong. That's not you, you. What you wrote was not right. It's not a bargaining chip. Well, if it wasn't that, then I don't know what it was, because that would make sense if it were a bargaining chip. I don't know what the point of it was if that's not what it was.
Yeah, because Dom, you're right. You know, we were hearing, like Woj said, $100 million. I'm like, well, geez, if he gets $100 million offer, he's gone. But then, Dom, you hear it's what, $70 million? All right, and you're in California. Look, Connecticut's no tax haven. You and I both know that. But you're in California. You automatically lose what, 10%, 11%, 12% when you're, you know, in that tax bracket.
I mean, Paul,
and I'm like, something like this didn't sound right.
No, well, Paul. We didn't know until yesterday that the offer was 6 years, $70 million. And that's just not enough. I mean, from what I understand, Monty Williams makes like $14 million a year.
Yeah.
If you're going to get the number one name in college coaching to jump the way the Celtics did with Patino, the way the Nets did with Calipari, who wasn't even the number one name at the time, you're not going to get him for less than the going rate of journeyman NBA coaches. And the fact is, if you factor in, you know, if UConn's offer is $50 million for 6 years and the Lakers offered $70 million for 6 years, then forget the cost of living and all of that. Just with the number of games involved, it's not even – I don't even think it's a race.
Yeah, no, you're right. So
twice as many games.
Yeah, so again, UConn is, and that was the next question I was going to ask you, Dom. So is that what you're hearing? The current offer on the table, 6 years, $50 million, about eight and change. Is that what the preliminary offer is now?
Well, I think that was what was intended to be the final offer. I'm guessing that he was promised something. Now, it may not be an increase in salary. That was his concern.
Mm-hmm.
It may be money for NIL, money for whatever the revenue sharing situation is going to be when it comes in, money for the program. It may be money for his assistants. It may be more of that than actual salary for him. But there was obviously something that he wanted that he did not get. And I don't think, by the way, this is David Benedict's doing either. I think it goes above him. But, you know, obviously, I mean, the governor got involved yesterday and said he was going to become the highest paid coach in college. Well, that would mean he would be that would be significantly more than $50 million for 6 years. That would be more like $60 million for 6 years. So I think it'll probably come in somewhere. I'm assuming they have a press conference Thursday, Paul. I'm assuming that they're going to announce a new contract at that point.
Yeah.
And if they do, I would think it would be maybe a little bit more than that 50 for 6 that we're hearing.
Yeah.
Not a lot more.
Dom Amore is the guest from the Hartford Courant, of course, a sports writer extraordinaire for years here in the state. So, Dom, I get a lot of people to call into the show and say, well, that's all my tax money. But I say, no, it's not. Dom, can you explain to my listeners how – now, UConn does it the way a lot of other schools do. Some schools don't. It's vastly different. But a relatively small amount of what we hear Hurley and Geno and Jim Mora Jr. get paid, there's a ceiling as to – how much they get paid actually as a state employee, correct?
Right. Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, no, there's a cap on their salary. In fact, it's like $400,000
yeah.
or thereabouts. most of it is in appearance fees and outside things. You know, it's not directly tax money. Sooner or later, it trickles down. But, you know, they comes from their budget with the money that they bring in through ticket sales and licensed items and TV money and what they raise. We know that they don't quite raise as much as they spend, you know, and the foundation steps in, and some of that ends up being passed along in the form of tuition or in the form of state money. But I mean, the idea that, you know, your taxes are going to go up because he gets a raise, it doesn't really work quite that directly. But, you know, it's a state school and every nickel's got to be accounted for. And anybody who has concerns about that, I certainly understand the concerns, because it's not
sure.
It's complicated as to where this money comes from. You just know, though, that if anybody in the state wanted to defund or de-emphasize the athletics up there, that would not be a popular choice, I don't believe.
No, and Dom, you mentioned NIL, and I've explained that to my listeners' name, image, and likeness. And it's amazing, Dom, between the one and dones, basically one guy here for a year, maybe two, not something that the women's game worries about, but rampant on the men's side. It's amazing, Dom, with the one and done specter we have now and the NIL stuff, that frankly, UConn is as good as they are. I mean, comparing stores to all these other major markets.
Well, that's the reason that Dan Hurley and Gino Auriemma are so indispensable. Because, you know, and first of all, this is a part of the country. It's not like other parts of the country where maybe the mere existence of the football team or the mere existence of the basketball team is enough to sell out an arena. You have to be successful here. You have to win. We saw a few years ago, when the fortunes fall, people stop coming to games. So this is an area almost like a pro franchise. You know, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. So guys who can win, or I don't want to say guys, coaches who can win in this environment are indispensable, you know, in terms of what the revenue that they can bring in to the school. So, I mean, you can just imagine what a disaster would have been if he left in June and the program kind of fell off the map for a couple of years while they dug out of the hole that they would have fallen into if he left. I mean, so, you know, I mean, you know, Gino particularly, the perception is when he leaves that the program's going to drop off a bit, because who's going to duplicate his charisma, his power to recruit the best players in the country year after year, which he's still doing. These guys, you know, that's why they command the salaries that they command. And, hey, we all know, hey, we'd like to see people maybe with more important jobs in our society make more than they do. But the fact is, you know, these guys make what they generate, and they make what the market bears that they should make. And, you know, the one thing I would say about, again, we get back to that bargaining chip thing
sure.
with Dan Hurley. You and I both know, I'm sure you and I have both learned firsthand, everyone has, that you're not going to get something you want out of an employer unless they're afraid of losing you, you know?
Yeah. So, no, you're right.
So you're going to negotiate, you got to play the game.
Absolutely. Dom Amore, Hartford Current. Dom, thanks. And by the way, folks, Father's Day is coming up, right? Wouldn't Dad love, if he's a Yankee fan, a copy of Dom's book? I'm not kidding you. This is a great book. I bought a copy. I have contributed to Dom's retirement fund, Franchise on the Rise, the first 20 years of the New York Yankees. Dom published it back in 2018 already. It's been 6-7 years now. Dom, how's the book been received, and what was the reaction?
I'm glad you said that, because I was looking for the guy who bought it.
Come on, stop. Well, you're talking to him.
You know, I mean, for the kind of book that it was, that's not a book with a big, that's going to have a big audience, like if you're writing, you know, an Aaron Judge book with Aaron Judge. But
yeah.
It did well. It was well received. People seemed to like it. And, you know, I'd certainly, if anybody buys it and wants to send it to me first, I'll certainly sign a copy if somebody wants to email me and meet me in a coffee shop somewhere. You know, I'd be happy to sign a copy for anyone who buys one on Amazon or wherever you might pick one up.
All right, Dom Amore. Dom, good to talk to you. We'll be in touch down the road. Dom Amore, sports writer extraordinaire at the Hartford Current. Dom, thanks. Be good, my friend. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Paul, thank you.
Bill. All right, bye-bye. Oh, look who's here. It's a Tuesday at this time. Megan Portfolio, Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Ms. Portfolio, how are you?
Hey, Ms. Sully, how you doing?
I'm okay. I'm bearing the slings and arrows here. So what have you unearthed for us on this merry week?
Oh, well, I wanted to tell you, I don't know if you saw my text message, Governor Lamont vetoed the striking workers bill.
Oh, he finally did. Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't check. Fine, you know, I was getting a little squishy on it. But I had somebody, Megan, on the show. I know it wasn't you, but because I mentioned it to somebody else, and they had heard that he's telling them work it in, allegedly work it into something that actually is like a real bill. Like, if you're going to try and sell me on this, I don't like it. Don't do it this way. So it'll likely pop up again.
Oh, no, it definitely is, because the big labor is already crying on social media. They clearly didn't even read the notice that Lamont put out, because they're, oh, he's siding with the CEOs. Lamont was just like, give me a bill that has like a mechanism to do this, and so that we can track the money. I'm just not going to give.
Well,
maybe he is,
Megan, siding with the CEOs, because he's a rich white guy from Fairfield County. So what's the news there? I'm kidding. I love the governor.
I know. It kind of leads me into why I wrote my column this week, titled, This is No Way to Run the Government.
All right.
So I kept getting bombarded with these emails from the greenies calling for this special session. I'm like,
the greenies.
No, like, you can't just call a special session. But then I started to think about it. Like, why do they feel so entitled that we're just going to stop everything, call the lawmakers in the middle of the summer to address whatever they want to address? They didn't even really say what they wanted in the email, just like climate change. I'm doing air quotes right now.
Mm-hmm.
But then I started to think about it. I watched the entire session, and The way things are being done in Hartford and how complacent we are with it, it needs to be reversed. Because, I mean, I've said it with you, you've said it with me, like, we joked about the implementer, oh, the rats, they're all in there.
Yeah.
Oh, the strike all amendments, oh, the dummy bills, that's just the way they do it. Well, they can't just do it that way anymore. It's this striking bill worker was like the tip of the iceberg with me with this nonsense. So I went through all the public acts that passed. So this year, I think there was about 2,000 bills that they put in. There's 175 public acts. Those are the ones that got voted out of both chambers. So out of that, 40% of those were strike all amendments.
Mm-hmm.
So they introduce a bill, it goes through a committee, it goes through a public hearing, it goes back to the committee again, which then they vote out, and then it hits the floor. Someone then stands up and says, oh, I'm going to do a strike all amendment, which means they basically delete all the language in the bill and replace it with some other language.
Okay.
Now, sometimes it's just the lawyers being lazy, and there's like a small change, and they don't feel like, you know, pointing out which sections change, so they just are lazy. But a lot of the times, like with the example of the striking workers bill,
mm-hmm.
they're literally taking a bill that started in one committee, stripping the language, putting completely new language, to bypass the entire process, put it in another committee, and then vote on it. And fortunately, Governor Lamont vetoed it. But 40%, Paul, like, get your act together. Come up, if you're going to propose a bill, let's have like some complete language, have it match the title so that the people that we elect can go through the bills, know what they're voting on, whether
yeah.
or not they want to vote it out, you know, make an intelligent decision based on what the constituents want, and do it that way. So that was one thing. And then as I was going through all these bills.
Yeah.
You know,
and
I
by the way, by,
you
by,
know what they called. By, oh, God.
By the way, you keep saying how many bills you went through. Like you should be canonized for a saint. You should.
I should be put in an asylum.
Anyway, yes. So you're going through more legislation in Hartford, and
as I'm seeing all these titles, Act Concerning Workers, Act Concerning Municipal Budgets, and you know what that is. That's just like, hello, I'm a dummy bill or a placeholder bill.
Yeah, yeah.
It's basically something that they do because they want to have like an ace in their pocket. So if whatever their little agenda is that they couldn't push through to the correct process, they could just kind of sneak it in at the end, kind of like with the striking workers bill.
So basically,
so I counted them all up.
Yeah.
There was 20 dummy bills. I mean, that's not acceptable. And some of the committees, like the Labor Committee, which is my kind of my favorite one to watch, but kind of my nemesis.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the WWE of all the committees. It's actually really entertaining. I really encourage anyone to watch it.
So you're telling me that Julie Kushner comes off the top rope with like an elbow? Is that?
And then Senator Sampson, you know, he goes back with like a choke slam, and it's amazing. But they have three dummy bills. I mean, one is bad enough. Why do you find like the necessity to have three bills that you can keep in your back pocket?
Yeah.
And then just kind of miraculously, we don't have time. Let's put it in here.
Yeah.
It's just the whole process needs to just be completely eliminated. It's not acceptable. There's ways, if you know something needs to change for whatever reason, you can do the amendment process. It can be transparent. This is not transparent. And I used to joke about it, too. We all joke, it's a dummy bill. But it's not funny anymore.
No, it's not.
Really got me.
Yeah, and what's happening, Megan, is basically this is a sleight of hand to subvert the real legislative process. And, you know, kudos to the Republican conferences up there, the caucuses. Listen, they may be down in numbers, but listen, when stuff like this happens, I'm for anything and everything they can do legislatively for delaying tactics here. Because if one side's going to do this, then you've got to at least recognize that you represent, meaning the Republicans, and I think they do get this, you represent a part of the state of Connecticut that says no to this. In fact, as you say, if more people knew about this, Megan, a lot of people in the middle and even some on the left would say, no, this is not how this should be done.
Well, that's another reason why I wrote the topic last week, because a lot of people in my family and friends who don't follow it nearly as closely as I do, God bless them, and that's why they walk around happy all the time. But they're like, I don't understand. They keep always saying, I don't understand. Yeah. How did that happen?
Exactly.
And then I'm like, if they don't understand how it's happening, and all I do is have this on like constantly 24/7, like if they don't understand, nobody understands. And it goes back to if you ever hear these lawmakers talk about, the disenfranchisement of voters, and we need to vote. 365 days. Let's just vote any day you want. But what about my disenfranchisement and every citizen, taxpayer, man, woman, child in this state during this legislative process? What about our disenfranchisement? What are you going to do about that? You only care to the point where you get elected, but then all of a sudden you're in. Who cares if you're disenfranchised?
Disenfranchised or disenfranchisement or any conjugation or contortion of that word, Megan, is a red flare for me. Okay, you have no viable points. So just say if we don't do it your way, you know, people are going to die of hunger in the streets. It's maddening. It's absolutely maddening.
There's like this. They have like a toolbox, and actually, I'm trying to help someone get some legislation passed up in Mass. It has nothing to do. It's like a nice bill.
Okay, yeah.
And I was like, I gave them all the buzzwords: disenfranchisement, accessibility, equity, equitable.
Equity's
I'm like,
big.
Use those words.
Equity's big.
It worked, actually.
Nice. I need
it worked for the phase one.
I need more equity every time I, you know, go out to eat. Listen, Megan Portfolio. Megan, thank you. Check out the Hartford Portfolio at the Yankee Institute. And Megan, tip of the cap for you. And just smile when your family members go, but Megan, how did that happen? Just keep smiling. It's good.
You've already triggered me for the day with the UConn coach making bank.
Well,
but as long as I don't have to pay for it, I don't care what he makes. But if it's on my dime.
Yeah, well, Megan, thanks. We'll chat next week. Be good.
All right.
All right, thanks. All right, Megan Portfolio there.